Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Friday, the 18th of October. On our program today, while the Government of National Unity faces an uphill battle around migration policies, a top business mind unpacks the changing role of corporates in shaping society, what your living arrangements could mean for your finances if things go pear-shaped, and what it'll take for fintech companies to provide better access to underserved communities. Migration has become a critical issue in South Africa's political discourse. The country has adopted progressive asylum and migration policies, but these often not resulting in a pragmatic migration governance approach. Several factors stand in the way, including bureaucratic inefficiency, the conflation of refugees and migrants, and politicized narratives about immigrants. Mabato Monghai, a data analyst at Good Governance Africa, is with me on the program now. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us. And firstly, let's outline, if we can, the scope of the problem.
So I think that it's relatively too early to give a concrete analysis in as far as what the GNU's migration model is. I think we can all agree that so far there is no, generally speaking, there is no pragmatic model from all spheres of society, economic, socially, migration, energy, and so forth. But as far as migration model is concerned, the GNU does find itself in a particularly tough position as it is dealing with national, regional, and international dynamics in as far as migration is concerned. So it's this fine balancing act that it has to do between maintaining its regional status as the big brother and, you know, your quote-unquote pan-African approach towards migration, and in the same breath dealing with the tensions, migration tensions in South Africa. And right now, where, you know, the country finds itself is this: on the one hand, you know, the government over the years has been implementing migration policies, and in the same breath they've been rising tensions and frustrations in as far as migration is concerned. And as we all know, policies take years and time to not only implement but to also see the effects of these policies that are being implemented. And while this waiting out period is in place, what do you do with growing frustrations that somewhat disregard the policies that may be in place?
And how are those growing frustrations that you refer to either manifesting right now, or potentially how could they give expression?
So I would highlight two main key ways that they find an expression. On the one hand, there's rising tensions in the midst of growing dissatisfaction with democracy, both satisfaction for and satisfaction with and support for democracy. So we see this, and not the only reason, but it's one of the contributing factors to things such as protest action, things such as lower voter turnout, aspects such as, you know, vigilant groups, where we've seen that rise in South Africa, people taking up their own means, feeling as though police, government is not taking their own actions. And this also finds, on the other hand, or the second way in which it finds an expression is through violent means. And it does not necessarily start with violence, but violence is the peak of that frustration. And over the years, we've seen sometimes violence being the first resort, but more often than not, we see that it first frustrations that accumulate into violence. But I think another important point to highlight is that in as far as the different ways in which frustrations find an expression is also through institutional means. Stats and data reveals that, because when we speak about migration, we normally speak about the tension that exists between your more poor communities versus your foreigners. But stats also show that some people surprise, you know, negative sentiments towards foreigners actually are more prevalent in your more educated and your more, you know, residents that live in urban areas. You know, that speaks into a whole nother conversation about the role in which socioeconomic dynamics contributes towards sentiments.
And why do you think this rising anti-immigrant sentiment is occurring within that cohort?
I think the answer lies just in that the socioeconomic dynamics. So this growing negative sentiments towards foreigners has been a persistent issue within South Africa from 1994 onwards. It's just that over the years, it's just found a more overt expression and a more violent expression. And South Africa is not the only country, but what sometimes differentiates South Africa from other countries is the violent nature of this expression. But once again, you know, with rise right now, unemployment is at about 33%. And I think about 27 million of South Africans are reliant on social grants. So, and what this also then highlights is that it's not necessarily an issue of xenophobia, as it is the core problems is the socioeconomic challenges that the country finds itself in. The Afrobarometer data shows that about 63% of South Africans oppose, well, number one, 63% of South Africans think that the government is doing an insufficient job at dealing with migration, and about half of the population are against foreigners because they believe that it is a threat to their livelihood and to their socioeconomic well-being. Once again, this supports the argument that the core issue here is socioeconomic well-being and the threat that foreigners are perceived to be in as far as livelihood, which means that no migration policy should be implemented in isolation to the socioeconomic challenges that the country is faced with. And we are yet to see actually any political party that moves away from the emotional rhetoric of things and taking advantage of that and rather speaking into long-term and sustainable solutions in as far as migration and socioeconomic
challenges. None of that is going to happen unless the GNU in its current format can reconcile the competing interests of parties right across the spectrum.
Precisely. And I think that the GNU finds itself in a very interesting position, almost like a double-edged sword that can either effectively address the matter or further exacerbate it. Because on the one hand, you know, there are 10 political parties represented, meaning that 10 parties that can speak into 10 different constituent groups, you know. But on the other hand, that how the message on migration is received is dependent on how these parties represented in the GNU understand migration, on their ability to really come to a consensus, because, you know, both left and right ideological views are represented. So their ability to really tackle, you know, formulate a pragmatic response will determine how the migration model is received.
Thank you very much for joining me today, Mabato Mongai from Good Governance Africa. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is not exactly a new question, but it is an important one that needs constant re-evaluation. I'm talking about the role of corporates in shaping society. It's the topic of this year's Serious Social Investing Conference, which is taking place in Johannesburg, and business leader Dr. Judy Dlamini, one of the speakers at the event that has looked at new pathways to growth and impactful social investing. And she joined me a little earlier. And first then, what's the big issue here, and how do you see the role of corporates evolving in shaping society beyond traditional CSR efforts? I wonder if all of this, of course, is happening quick enough.
The gauge for that for me, Jeremy, is the inequality gap we have in the country. which is not abating, and it's not getting even halved. So all those that have the means are then responsible. So you can't say it's good enough. It will only be good enough if we can actually have timelines as to when are we going to have it. And that involves igniting human capacity. It involves creating opportunities for everyone, especially those that are furthest left behind, to be participants in this economy. Right now, they are not. And it's not sustainable.
So it's important, I think, that corporates up their game in this respect. Do you think that there is a sense sometimes that they use social investment simply as a public relations or a reputational tool rather than driving real, important, significant, meaningful impact?
There are some who use it as a real tool, but I think in the majority, it's a ticker box exercise and or a PR exercise. So I think we need to change it from just measuring the amount spent, to impact. If we have to measure impact, it will focus people in the right place. It's one thing to give bursaries to 100 students at wits, as an example. It's something completely different to be able to say, we have, yes, given 100 bursaries, but you know what? 70% of those that we gave bursaries have qualified in the shortest period of time. For a three-year degree, they've qualified in 3 years. You know what I'm saying? So we need measurables that measure impact as opposed to input. So we need output that talks to impact.
And Judy Dlamini, have you applied your mind then to new thinking on the way in which impact can be measured?
Well, it starts just by that to say, FirstRand, as an example, over the past 5 years, you've spent 1 billion rand for a number on bursaries. Show us the impact and let's agree on the criteria and the measurables. One is qualification within the allocated time. What that talks to Jeremy is focus by the funder on the wraparound support to the students, because we put a lot on emphasis on money, and money is only part of it. But when you have a student that comes from rural KZN or Eastern Cape, for instance, they have to acclimatize to a new environment, a new way of teaching and so forth. But if you have a wraparound like the Tutuga Bursary Fund projects like Umthombo Youth Fund, which actually looks at the psychological aspect, the extra tutorials, and so forth. That has an impact on the outcomes. So if you say to Corporate South Africa, because they are quite good at implementing what is going to be measured, so it matters therefore to measure the right things. So if you are saying an output of 80% qualified bursary holders within the allocated time, they would then make it their business to check how they can achieve that. I hope I'm making
You are
sense.
making sense. What I would like to ask you now, though, is what more can be done to hold corporates accountable for the long-term impact of that social investment that we've been speaking about?
By changing what you're measuring. You know, the BE scorecard. What are we measuring right now? Amount spent. Is that what was expected? Yes. Tick in the box, we're good. Right? And I'm saying let's change that. You need to beef up what you're measuring for you to get the desired outcome. People pouring money into something is not the desired outcome. It's a starting point. What is the desired outcome? What are you solving for? If you say, as a university, and I'm using education because I'm closer to it, if you say, as an education, we have these PhDs that are churning out IP, how are you going to measure if that IP is changing the dynamics in the country is relevant? By how many of those IPs are actually commercialized? If you measure that, instead of, we have so many patents as a university, 100 patents, great, but how many of them are actually commercialized? How many businesses are we starting out of that, those patents? So it really is about what you're solving for, and are you measuring outcomes for what you're solving for? Not just numbers.
There is an argument that corporate social investment should be mandatory. Does that sit well with you?
Of course it does. The bigger problem we have, Jeremy, is that our democracy is at risk as long as we have the majority not participating in this economy. We have the majority not well equipped to participate. So anything that gives a country a risk, I mean, corporate South Africa understands this. You mitigate against risk, you put it up there, top 10 risk, mitigation, probability, and all those good things. Let's do that for the country, because for us to have sustainable businesses, we need a sustainable country.
Judy Dlamini, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Genuine financial inclusion is vital if we're to bring millions of unbanked and underserved communities in Africa into the mainstream economy. This doesn't just benefit the communities, it has a knock-on effect for economies, regions, and the continent. Financial services are tightly regulated, and this presents a challenge for fintechs. So how do you innovate while working effectively within differing regulatory frameworks on the continent? While these frameworks may differ substantially, there are common barriers that fintechs need to overcome. Nikki Kettles is Executive Licenses and Payments Regulation at the money transfer company Mukuru, and she's with me now. Nikki, a warm welcome. And what then are the biggest regulatory barriers that fintechs are facing when trying to reach these underserved communities?
So the broadest barrier that exists, and it's not just underserved communities, it's everywhere, is onboarding people into the formal financial system. The formal financial system, we need to keep the integrity of it, because really that runs economies, and we need to know every single person that is going to be working in that or doing payments in that. So the onboarding, what we call the KYC, know your customer process, is one of the biggest hurdles to bringing people into the system, and especially in the underserved communities, because often they don't have an address or they don't have an ID document for a whole lot of reasons. As we know, there's a whole lot of eco and social reasons about that. That is the challenge, especially with underserved communities.
Surely though, Nikki, technology is assisting in this respect right now?
Absolutely. Technology is making it slicker, as we would say. You still need an ID document. The one thing that we are not allowed to do is to bring an anonymous person into the system. So we need to identify and verify that, you know, Jeremy giving me his ID is Jeremy and he is registered, and we need to do that. And technology is helping. It's getting better. There are links going into Home Affairs departments now, and that whole digitization process, you can do it on your phone. But the checks and balances still need to be done.
The difficulty, of course, is balancing the all-important regulatory compliance with, I guess, a need to innovate and serve these populations that you've just outlined for me. Again, how do you find that balance so everyone is best served?
Oh, my favorite topic. I spent 9 years working for a nonprofit in bringing, it was poverty alleviation and bringing people into the formal financial system. There has to be a balance between proportionality, and if I'm sending 10 rands worth of money versus 100,000 rands worth of money, it has to be around access. And the transaction monitoring and starting to understand how the transactions flow should actually reduce the barrier on onboarding, because you'll bring someone in, but if you start to see unusual transactions, you can catch them there. So those are huge things that we need to look at and work with the regulators, because their best interest is integrity in the system. However, we would rather have people in the system than out. It's not a good thing to have cash going across our borders. the regulator would rather see it. So that is the big conundrum, and the continuous, that's where evolution comes in and looking at new ways of doing it and working very closely with the regulators.
In that respect, do you think the regulators are sympathetic to this cause?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially, well, we have found the SA South African regulation over the last 15 years has evolved really nicely. Grey listing, Jeremy, is an issue. So, you know, we need to balance with that because we don't want to bring any more risk into the system. But the regulators are empathetic and they understand proportionality. You know, in terms of some of the UN and G20 targets we need to reach as a country, we need to reduce the cost of sending cross-border remittances into the region. And we know that it's the onboarding that's the problem. So they're doing a lot of work to ensure proportionality and trying to ensure that we can bring more people into the system.
And Nikki, what about the banks themselves? Are they working hard enough to be more incorporative?
So, interesting question, because the banks and the fintechs have always operated differently. Our licenses are different to the ones the banks have. There are initiatives to actually bring the banks and the fintechs closer. I mean, right now, in terms of cross-border remittances, and the figures are slightly old, but when I was at Finmark, 90% of all cross-border remittances, so for the low-value underserviced, was not sent by the banks. It was sent by Adlers and fintechs. But I think that there's a huge move for them to, you know, they really want to get involved and to start understanding that. But it's quite a different value proposition, a fintech Adler from a banking environment.
And more broadly, how do differing regulations across African countries impact and complicate the matter?
Sure, hugely. They really do hugely make it more complex. You know, the principles of the regulations are generally the same because the central banks are trying to, you know, avoid certain aspects in their market. The principles are the same. It's how it's interpreted and how it's implemented in country. We just find keeping a really close relationship with our regulator and also understanding why that regulation is there. Don't just read it and say, oh, they want this. This is silly. Understand why it's there and then work through how you can do it and what is a better way of doing. But it is very challenging. There are different limits for onboarding people across the region and Africa. There are different payments that are allowed to happen in certain ways, and it does become very challenging. I mean, we've got 49 licenses on the continent in 15 countries. It's quite a juggle, but it's getting better. They're trying to standardize. But you know, there's country dynamics and economics that will always impact it, Jeremy.
Nikki Kettles, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Executive of Licenses and Payments Regulation at Mukuru, a fintech. I do appreciate your time and the explanation today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to a topic that many couples will probably face without realizing the potential consequences. What am I talking about? Well, living together without any formal agreement. Nicole van den Monkhoff from Independent Securities is going to join us and breaks down the financial risks and what you can do to protect yourself if your relationship ends. By the way, I hope it doesn't, but nonetheless, it's important, I think, and maybe we should get ready for what I hope is an eye-opening conversation on cohabitation and finances. Nicole, welcome then. And in your opinion then, what are the most common financial risks that couples face when living together without a so-called formal agreement?
So a formal agreement would be a cohabitation agreement, and that would very much be a contract. So it's a very formal document. It is a contract. You would usually go to a lawyer to have such a contract drafted. And pretty much what that sets out is just the boundaries of the relationship. So what are the kind of expectations of the relationship, but also what happens if the relationship should end? So obviously when you're living together, there's assets that are being acquired and you're living your life. Person one is paying for X, person two is paying for Y, and so we carry on. The problem comes in that your cohabitation, when you are living together, none of our current matrimonial property acts, or none of the current acts that deal with matrimonial property actually consider cohabitation as someone being your spouse. So it's not a recognized spouse, so it's not covered by any of those acts. And the extension thereof is that when you get divorced, it's also not covered by any of the acts that deal with divorce. So really, you are exposing yourself quite a bit if you don't have a cohabitation agreement or something that dictates the terms of the relationship should the relationship end.
Nicole, I know this sounds like a very much a baby boomer question, and I guess I am a baby boomer, but is there a clear definition in the modern idiom of what cohabitation actually is? Is there a clear definition?
So there are certain acts within our law, for example. So anything that relates to tax, our tax acts look at marriage, and that includes cohabitation. And there's a very clear definition of cohabitation in there. So in terms of cohabitation, I think for the purpose of this discussion is where you really are living together under the same roof and you're kind of dealing and you're facing life as a unit and as a couple. So I think for the purposes of this conversation, certainly that's what it means, you know, where you are sharing your life together and you're running life as a unit, basically.
And that's critical, isn't it? It's not just about sharing the dog or the cat. It's about sharing expenses.
Exactly. It's about sharing expenses and also sharing assets. So if someone is buying a house and the property is in one person's name, when that relationship dissolves, the second party that's possibly been contributing to the maintenance and possibly the bond of that house is ultimately not really entitled to anything from a legal perspective unless somewhere it's been captured or unless there's been some form of contract that makes provision for that.
How does income disparity between partners complicate the situation?
So quite severely, and it's a very difficult road to navigate. So income disparity, either if you're splitting expenses 50-50, then income disparity can become a huge problem because one person then has the opportunity to save, but the other person who's possibly earning less doesn't have the opportunity to save. So that also causes a lot of friction and can really be detrimental to the person who earns less if the relationship should end, because ultimately they're going to walk away with nothing where the person who's earned more has possibly saved some money. So it is a huge problem, and it's something, you know, that you really need to seriously sit down and have the conversation, and that's why an agreement is so important, so that you can understand, but how are we actually, so that we can formally have the discussion and how are we actually facing our day-to-day lives. Because when the relationship ends, you need to make sure you cover yourself. The agreement isn't for now. No agreement is for the onset of a relationship, whether it be a formal, you know, work contract or, you know, any agreement is for when there's a bit of friction in a relationship so that the parties are covered for those instances.
And in the first flush of excitement in moving in together, that is a very difficult conversation to have, isn't it?
It is a very difficult conversation, and some people are quite closed off where they don't like to disclose that type of information even to their partners. But it is important to know and to know where you stand with your partner, because if you don't set those terms out from the beginning, it can become quite messy and it can complicate your life quite a bit. And you can end up walking away, I think, even more bitter from a relationship than, you know, it can really get ugly.
And in the work that you do you see a lot of tears and heartache?
Well, certainly. And I mean, I think the end of any relationship is terrible. And I think the splitting up of a long-term relationship is no less traumatic than divorce. I've seen it with a lot of clients where it's either a long-term relationship or divorce. And I think that, you know, the amount of heartache that goes along with that is very much the same. It's not to say that divorce is worse, but at least with divorce there is, you know, there's a process to follow and it's very formal, where with cohabitation it does get messy. And oftentimes what happens is, you know, people, they don't want to fight and they don't want to stand up for themselves, so they end up losing quite a bit, and ends up costing them quite a bit of money. So I think from that perspective, you know, it is important to cover yourself, and it is important if you are going the agreement route, do it in a formal way. Go and see a lawyer and have a lawyer set it up. Don't just write it on a piece of paper, kind of like, well, we have an understanding, because, you know, worse comes to worse. You need to take that agreement, and a court needs to decide what should happen if it gets completely out of hand.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that agreement. You're absolutely right. I mean, it can't just be on the back of a serviette. So, is there a boilerplate or a pro forma type of agreement, or does it entirely depend on what the couple wants and what the couple owns?
So I think, I'm sure if you go and look up, you could find, you know, templates for these kinds of agreements. But I do think that it is very couple specific. And it also depends on where you are in your relationship, you know, in terms of the length of the relationship. So, you know, if you're at the start of the relationship, well, does it warrant? Are we serious enough to have a cohabitation agreement? And if you're kind of in the thick of things and you've been doing this for years, then certainly it does. So I think it's very situation dependent and you know, it needs very careful consideration. It's not just a slap bang, get it done kind of tick box exercise. You need to put some thought into it.
And don't forget about the dog, Nicole. Someone's got to take the dog, man.
Well, yeah, I mean, in my own relationship, you know, it's always been a thing if we were to split up, well, who gets the dog? We've now got a child, so it makes it slightly more complicated, but it used to be a big conversation of, well, who would get the dog?
Difficult choice between the child and the dog, hey? But let's not go down that route.
Let's not go down that route.
All right. Nicole, thank you very much indeed. A very interesting and I think a very important conversation. Nicole van den Monkhoff from Independent Securities, thank you for joining me. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.